107. We're ready whenever you are, Ms. Weimer. Am I saying your name correctly? Weimer?
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Joni Ray Weimer. I'm here on behalf of Parvati Corp. And as the court is aware, we're appealing a ruling denying a motion we filed under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B3, which had alleged fraud, misconduct, and misrepresentation. And the reason that we're appealing is we think that the stated rationale of the district court was in conflict with decisions of this court in Lonsdorf versus Seyfelt and Thai Inc. versus Softbellies, as well as a decision of the Fifth Circuit in Rosier versus Ford Motor Company.
And before you get to your argument, I wanted to clarify something. Does Parvati currently own the property or not? It seemed a little unclear from the brief.
It is unclear. The reason that it's unclear, the issue was raised in the district court. Parvati defaulted on its loan, and it executed a deed in lieu of foreclosure, tendered it to Mutual Bank, which was the mortgagee. Notwithstanding that, then Mutual Bank turned around and filed a foreclosure action in which they named Parvati as the owner of the property. Mutual Bank also filed a list pendants naming Parvati as the owner of the property. So there's questions as to whether the deed in lieu was accepted. It's under Illinois law, I think it's Section 15-1504 of the Code of Civil Procedure. If they accept the deed in lieu, they accept it subject to liens and encumbrances of record. And in the foreclosure action, they're trying to cut off an easement that Parvati granted to a billboard company. So it's not clear that Mutual Bank accepted the deed in lieu of foreclosure. If they didn't, then Parvati still owns the property because the foreclosure action is still pending. Anyway, the case was an administrative review proceeding initially before the Planning and Zoning Commission of the City of Oak Forest, and they decided it based on a zoning ordinance of the city, which was amended by Ordinance Number 2836. And what that ordinance did is there was a zoning district, a manufacturing district in the city, and there was only one manufacturing district, and it's referred to sometimes as the M District or the M1 District. But under the old ordinance, there was only one manufacturing district, and it's a particular area within the city. Ordinance Number 2836 purported to create two different districts, M1 and M2, out of the former limited manufacturing district. And they changed the uses that were permitted from the former limited manufacturing district into these two different zones. But they failed to designate what areas of the former limited manufacturing district were going to be M1 and which were going to be M2. We didn't know that at the time, and there's state law, there's cases we've cited from Illinois Supreme Court that says if you don't do that, the ordinance is void.
Well, didn't you know the city attorney sent, I thought, an email October 19th of 06 alerting your client to potential problems with the zoning map, right?
They sent us an email that said that your property was M2 at the time. They said the zoning map that we used at the hearing was out of date, and everybody knew that because they had only had the one zone.
Well, in the administrative record filed in the case says the map used at the zoning hearing was correct, right? So, I mean, and the point is that your client was on notice that there were problems with this thing and never...
We were not on notice that they had failed to make the designation, Judge Williams, because they can make the designation by ordinance citing permanent parcel numbers. This permanent parcel number is M1, this one's M2. The fact that they had an outdated map didn't mean that they hadn't made the designation required by Illinois law. And we had no reason to believe that they hadn't. And they testified under oath in the zoning proceeding, the city officials did, that they had made the designation even though they hadn't. And they also, in the footnote and the email, both say your property was M2 at the time, but our map was out of date. So they misled us under oath before the Planning and Zoning Committee and in the footnote that was filed with the district court and in the email. What happened was, if we had known...
Let me just go a little further on this. Well, did the city do anything to prevent you from raising questions about the validity of the M2 zoning?
Only by telling us that they had done what they hadn't done. And if they had done what they, under oath, and if they had done what they hadn't done, there would have been no question as to the validity of the M2 zoning. The fraud and misrepresentation was telling us we designated what parcels of the former M district were going to be M1 and which were going to be M2, and they hadn't. And we alleged that that was an intentional misrepresentation, and they didn't deny that in their response of pleading to our Rule 60 motion.
Are all these transactions public record? I mean, all these proceedings are public record,
Your Honor, but there are many, many, many zoning ordinances that change. I mean, we're in litigation now. We have 3 pages of single-spaced ordinances that change the zoning in that city over a period of time. I think that the point I'm trying to make, Judge, is you could say my client was negligent in not figuring this out. But that's the whole point that we're saying, is that under Thai Inc. versus Soft Bellies and under Rossier, it doesn't matter if we should have realized that they were defrauding us, because negligence is not a defense to intentional misconduct under Rule 60b-3. That was this court's decision in Thai.
Well, no, I understand the rule of that case. My point gets to the nature of the misrepresentation, which is to say that there's a dispute about the validity of the rezoning, which is a legal question. The validity of the ordinance is a legal issue, and you can't premise a misrepresentation claim on a misrepresentation of a legal issue. And if the underlying facts of the municipal transactions that determine the validity of the ordinance are a matter of public record,
I think whether a city enacts an ordinance or not is a question of faith.
But that's all going to be a matter of public record. You just go to City Hall and you pull the files and you look at them. And
let me respond by saying in Rossier, which is the decision of this court that I'm talking about, it was a sexual harassment case, and the fraud was introducing an altered document at trial. And Ms. Rossier always had the unaltered document in her possession. And the district court, in denying her 60B3 motion, said, you should have known about this. You had the unaltered training schedule from day one. And this court said, that doesn't matter. The fact that she could have or should have been able to figure out that she was being hoodwinked is not a defense to a 60B3 motion. And that was the problem with the district court's ruling here. Judge St. Eve is trying to gloss onto one of the provisions, one of the 3 factors in Lansdorf, a diligence requirement that was specifically rejected in Lansdorf. If you get fooled because the other side gives false testimony under oath, the fact that if you had been more diligent, you would have discovered that you were being fooled and you would have raised another issue is not a defense to a 60B3 motion under the circuit's precedent. The other basis that the district court gave for denying our 60B3 motion is she said you can't raise an issue for the first time in a 60B3 motion. And that's where I cited the Rossier case, because that was a case involving a car crash where the fuel tank erupted and burned the occupant. Just briefly, in Rossier, because you see him in my rebuttal time, in Rossier, They didn't raise an issue as to failure to warn subsequent to the purchase of the vehicle based on discovery misconduct by Ford Motor Company in quashing a certain study. And the court said, well, they should be allowed to raise that issue. The reason they didn't is because of the fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct. I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
All right. You want to save your time, Ms. Wimmer? All right. No problem. Mr. Rewberry? And did I pronounce that correctly, sir? All right.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, I represent the city of Oak Forest in this appeal, and the plaintiff has devoted about 40 pages to briefing this matter, and what is noteworthy is not what's in the brief, but what is not in the brief. What the plaintiff or appellant fails to do in this case is come to grips with the basic issue here. Did the district court abuse its discretion in denying the Rule 60B3 petition? That question is largely left unanswered. Abuse of discretion, the standard is very simple. Could a reasonable person agree with the district court's decision? And the district court issued no fewer than two well-written, well-reasoned, cogent opinions in which it denied Parvati's request for relief. And in so doing, it made some factual findings, which Parvati has not elected to challenge.
Well, did you notify Parvati or the court when the city updated the zoning map March 28th, 06?
Did we notify them?
Yes.
I did not, Judge, because I will tell you what, we had just removed the case, I think, 2 days before. So I personally did not. I was not representing the city. I was
at that time. Well, no. Was the city under any discovery obligation that would have required an update to Parvati as to the facts and the changing circumstances?
Well, the question I think is, well, A, they never asked, and B, this case pended 18 months before it was voluntarily dismissed by Parvati and Bethlehem, and at no point did they take a single deposition. We took depositions, and gosh, we learned during those depositions that Reverend Smith never intended to open an extended stay hotel on this property, which really kind of bugs me because my clients are accused of fraud when, in our view, this whole notion of an extended stay hotel is, in our view, borderline fraud. And we've proved that. We've incorporated matters in the record which show that they never intended to do that. If they intended to do that, they sure didn't tell the Small Business Administration, and they surely did not tell their bankers.
Were any affirmative representations made in the first litigation that the M2 valid?
Judge, in our brief, we responded and we, I think, obliquely referred to the M2 zoning.
Right, that's why I was asking the direct question.
Right. Essentially, Judge, what was the way the administrative review count was fought out was we were saying this is a residential use. They're saying, no, it's a hotel use. And our position was that it was an improper use irrespective of whether it was M1 or M2 because you're putting a residential use in the middle of a bunch of warehouses. In other words, a warehouse for people, among other warehouses for goods. And that's been the city's position from day one.
So there were affirmative representations in the first litigation that the M2 zoning was valid, but your point is it doesn't matter.
It does not matter, Judge, because we have to remember what they're trying to do here. And what they don't put in their brief.
And that wouldn't have prompted them to then do some discovery, learning that fact.
The only person who could answer that question is the original attorney. And interestingly, we don't have an affidavit from him saying, I would have done A, B, and C had I known this. But the fact is he did know this. And they made a litigation. They made a strategic or tactical decision to pursue administrative relief in a certain way. And I have to emphasize, Judge, in most, as you know, most administrative review cases, there's no discovery. You know, the zoning board makes a decision. You have the administrative record, and that's it. They had every opportunity to take depositions. At one point, they probably could have even deposed the members of the zoning board because they hadn't dismissed out of the case. I think that happened almost a year after the case was filed and well after discovery had been instituted in the case. So what we have here, Judge, is information that would have certainly prompted, I think, an attorney to question the validity of the ordinance if he chose that particular line of attack. But we don't know what the workings of the attorney's minds were because we have no affidavits from him. The attorney's not here. He's no longer involved in the case. But what we have here is a new attorney coming in and essentially using 20/20 in hindsight saying, gosh, if we'd known this And if these alleged misrepresentations had not been made, we would have done A, B, and C. But the fact is, at an administrative review, the argument was, you call it a hotel, I call it a residential complex. And that's how it was fought out, and that was their choice. They made that choice. And we have to go back to the prehistory, because if you look at their brief, it just seems that Reverend Smith and Parvati showed up one day and wanted to get a business license for a hotel. That is not the case. For at least 12 months prior to that application, they repeatedly told the village, we want to open a senior living facility. In other words, a full-time residential facility. Not a, and again, they never changed their business plan, and as we've established in the record, that it was never Bethlehem's intention to open a hotel. And so for that reason, this whole notion of the, you know, the ordinance's validity or non-validity, that's something they chose not to raise. And we didn't prevent them from doing that, and the court specifically found that. And the issue is, with respect to the findings that Judge St. Eve made, could a reasonable person make those findings? And I think with respect to each one, the answer to that is yes, conclusively so.
What about the ownership question? Is that pending somewhere?
Well, Judge, you know, they have, right now, there's another individual operating a hotel on that property who shares the same last name as the owners of Parvati Corporation, Mr. Patel. And Mr. Patel's been in business for over 2 years now. So, you know, the issue becomes, you know, what injury is there left to address? If this is remanded to the Zoning Commission as they apparently want the court to do, what are they going to decide? Because they're not in a position to seek a business license of any kind for that property. I don't think the bank is going to throw out the gentleman who's running the property now. He's made huge investments into the property. So at this juncture, there really is no injury to be addressed, because they really no longer own the property. They may own it technically, but the only reason they own it is because they put an easement on their property and they didn't bother to tell their mortgage holder about it. That's what's holding it up. But, you know, as counsel admitted, they're in default. I think that the mortgage foreclosure case has been pending for over 2 years now. So, if there's any prospect of redemption or them taking the property back, it certainly isn't in the record and hasn't been suggested today.
Well, do we have to take the case on the assumption that Parvati has standing?
I don't think they have standing because, again...
But how could this court determine?
Well, I think standing was something we raised in our brief, and we certainly raised before the district court, so there's certainly no waiver. What we've done is argue, Judge, that there's no Act 2 here.
Yeah, but doesn't the district court's ruling on count 1 affirming the Zoning Commission have some effect on the second litigation?
I don't think so. I mean, I represent the city. Yes, the district court did find that perhaps it could affect qualified immunity analysis.
Right. So that ruling that the Zoning Commission's decision was valid does go to the claims that Parvati has brought against the various city officials in the new suit, even if it's just tangential.
Well, it could be tangential, but the problem is that if it goes back under those circumstances, what's next? Do we have a new administration?
Well, there are also some claims left, right?
Sure. There are other pending federal claims, Judge. And but what it comes down to is, where do we go from here? What does the district court do? Do we have a new administrative review briefing? Does it go back to the Zoning Commission? What exactly would be litigated with respect to count one?
Well, that's what Ms. Wimmer certainly would like. Whole relitigation of the whole thing opened up again.
Sure, but if we do that, then the standing issue becomes apparent, because the court's not in a position to offer any relief on that count, because Parvati no longer possesses and, as far as we're concerned, no longer owns the property. It can't go back then to the zoning commission and say, well, I want my business license now. It's impossible.
How does that affect their standing on the new suit? But the new lawsuit is for a money judgment, right?
As was the old one. There were 1983 claims for various types of damages. There were 1981 claims as well.
But also the administrative review of the zoning board's decision. That's what the first case was primarily about, and the other claims were also in the suit but were voluntarily dismissed, as I understand it.
Well, I wouldn't say it was primarily about administrative review. That was the one count that was, for which a dispositive ruling was issued.
And you've asserted preclusive effect of that dispositive ruling in the new suit, right?
Well, what the court has done, what the Judge St. Eve has done, has determined that that claims concerning the invalidity of the ordinance could have been raised, and she indicated that what transpired before the lawsuit was filed has no real application to the res judicata analysis. It's what occurred after the suit was filed.
So she gave it preclusive effect.
She did, as to certain counts, certain state law count, I believe.
And why doesn't that supply standing? Setting aside your question about what happens next.
Because she was not relying on the finding of the administrative review count when she found that. She was basically saying that these were claims that could have been brought in the original lawsuit and were not. They were available. So it really had nothing to do with the administrative review count. What she was saying is that under this, in her order, was that questions concerning the validity or invalidity of the ordinance certainly could have been raised in the lawsuit independent of any administrative review count, and they were not. If there are no further questions, I think my time is up.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruberry. And how much time does Ms. Wimmer have? 1 minute, Ms. Wimmer.
I'll talk fast then. The judge certainly did rely on res judicata of the judgment in throwing out two new counts on our 08 case, and we've submitted the order to this court, and the court has taken that motion under advisement that you take judicial notice of her order. The issue is not abuse of discretion, and we've cited the Jaffe case of this court that says when the issue is whether the court applied proper principles of law in deciding it, that's something this court decides de novo. We cited Jaffe and Central States to that effect, and that's what we're arguing. The other thing is there certainly was intentional misrepresentation and false testimony. Mr. Dotson got up at the zoning board and said, as we move towards I-57 in the corner of 167th, that is where the zoning has changed to M2, heavy industrial. He said the dark area on the map was M2. Nuquist said it. This M1 is the Frito-Lay warehouse. They lied to us and said they had divided it up into M1 and M2, and that's why we didn't challenge that in the administrative review action. If we had, it would have been successful under state law.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wimmer. We thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefs. We will take this case under advisement.